are sovereign, and we love that. We love that we are not sovereign, but we love that you are. But you've given us things to do. And please help us to understand where power fits into all of that. Let us always remember that you are the one who is in charge of these things and of structuring our lives and the way the world works. And let us take joy in that. Thank you. Please pervade in this place, and may your spirit move in our hearts and our minds. And may we come away different. In Jesus' powerful name, amen. All right, well, welcome, welcome. We're going to talk about power and vulnerability and medicine and missions and things like that. And power is kind of a heady subject. I'm going to be very interested in your perspective. Everybody's had experiences with power, and so there are a lot of opinions and perspectives in here that we want to take advantage of. But I find that when we're talking about power, it's important to understand the perspective of the other people that we're working with. So let me just share a little bit. First of all, I love the Lord Jesus and I want to follow His way. So that's the most important perspective. I'm an emergency medicine doc. I was in the Navy for 25 years, and so I completed that and retired at the rank of captain, which is similar to an Army colonel, but it's better because it's in the Navy. So, but that's a given, isn't it? During the time in the Navy, I deployed twice to the war in Afghanistan. The Navy medical takes care of the Marine Corps, so that's what we were doing there. And during that time, we engaged in a fair amount of power and vulnerability sort of issues, including taking care of enemy who were brought in injured. And so there was a significant amount of power and vulnerability there, and we learned a lot about combat medicine ethics and taught those sorts of things later on. After finishing up with the Navy, I then became a medical missionary. Yay! And went to Chogoria, Kenya, a wonderful place on the eastern slopes of Mount Kenya, and we started a family medicine residency there. And there were more power-vulnerability dynamics. When we went there, we were the first Westerners to be there in about 10 years, and so there was all sorts of stuff going on there. Many things to work with. So I've been rather a student of power and vulnerability and authority and leadership for quite some time. But again, most important perspective is a follower of Jesus and His way. Currently, I'm working with in member care with healthcare missionaries, and one of those functions is with a group called Alongside, which is a wonderful counseling organization that I have been a patient there or a client there. But we help healthcare missionaries who are struggling in particular. And one of the issues that's really common is an issue of power and vulnerability and, you know, power issues. So we continue to work with that. I should mention that I don't have a formal degree in healthcare ethics or anything like that. I'm more of a from the school of hard knocks. So that's my perspective. So power. Ah, what do you think about that when you hear that word? I mean, do you seek power? Do you shun power? How do you feel about it? Are you suspicious of power? Doesn't power corrupt? What should we do with that? What does power have to do with medicine? Is power even appropriate to talk about in the sequence of medicine? Isn't it more appropriate to talk about things like competence? And let's put power aside. We're a bit shy about that. Well, what about power in the situation of missions? If we have power as medics, is it wrong to use that power around patients who are vulnerable? Is it appropriate to engage in spiritual discussions if we are in a position of authority or power in relation to our patients? Well, I think those are all important questions. We'll have some opportunity to talk about some of those. But let's think about some dynamics of power, how it works. Okay. If person A has power over person B, then person B is by definition vulnerable to the power of person A. Right? Pretty basic. Power and vulnerability. A police officer has power. They have authority. They have the power to take away people's liberty, right? Handcuffs, things like that. It's statutory power. They have the statutory power to cause harm, if necessary, or even take life if necessary. How about that? And the general population does not have that authority, does not have that legal power, and is therefore vulnerable to that power. A public official has power. A public official has a power to tax, to take your money, whether you like it or not. And to use, well, does anybody like that? But they have the power to take that and to use it for whatever they feel is the best is the best entity, right? So they have that power. They can take land or make laws that we all have to follow. And so they have that authority, that power. Why do they have that power? Because power is righteously used for the benefit of the vulnerable, right? Police officer has the power to restrain or cause harm and that sort of thing, but it is supposed to be used for the benefit of the general population. The restraints really should be those who do not respect the rule of law. They have the power to restrain those people, keep them from causing further harm. The public official has the power to tax and to make laws, but those are supposed to be used for the benefit of the vulnerable, of the rest of us who put them in power. That's why we give them that power in the first place. Abuse of that power is when people use their personal power, and we are talking about interpersonal power here, they abuse that power for their own benefit or for some other reason. If a police officer uses their power in a mean-spirited way or to advance themselves, that is an abuse of power, and we hate that, right? That's in the news when there's an abuse of power from those powerful people. If a public official abuses power, they are using their power to feather their own nest or to further their cronies or something like that, and we really hate that. We have laws about that in particular, insider trading, things like that. So that's an indication of abuse of that power that should be righteously used for the benefit of the vulnerable. Does that make sense? Okay. So let's turn the corner then and think about medicine. And I would invite you all to explore that, maybe groups of 2 to 5, so just some people around you, and I would invite you to consider from a medical perspective, in what ways are our patients vulnerable to us as medics, and in what ways are we powerful? Let's take about 5 minutes and see what you come up with. In what ways are our patients vulnerable, and in what ways are we powerful? Again, about 5 minutes, and then we'll share with each other a little bit. Right. So does anyone have a particular observation that you'd like to share with the group? What did y'all come up with? In what ways are our patients vulnerable to us, and what are the kind of powers that we have in comparison to that vulnerability? Who would anyone be willing to share what you just discussed? Go ahead. That was one of those things like making a bid at an auction, right? Just a hand. Go ahead.
Within our group here, we shared that the patient, start off with the patient being vulnerable, your patient has to be trusting and willing enough to share all the signs and symptoms that they're experiencing in order to have an accurate diagnosis. If your patient is not feel comfortable with sharing all the details, you run a higher risk of missing something and
Hey, terrific. Absolutely. You bet. Our patients are vulnerable in sharing information that they might not share with just about anybody, right? That's a vulnerability. Well said. Good. Others? Yes, please.
We were just talking about how like the knowledge that we have from our training is power, and the lack of knowledge in this specific field, that whatever it is your role is the vulnerability on their end. So the trust they give you in that you do have the knowledge to do that, or the trust that they would hold, because they are worried about the abuse of that power of the knowledge that you have.
You bet. Perfect. Well said. Yeah. In some ways, power is knowledge, or knowledge is power. If someone doesn't have it and they need it, and you have it, okay, that is an important distinction. And they are vulnerable, not knowing whether what we're saying is true or not. What's that advice? How are they going to act on it? Do you have something else?
Yeah, in 911, patients are vulnerable. They invite you into their home.
Oh, wow. Yeah, sure. Okay. You might discover things there, huh? Sure. Great. Go ahead.
Bianca and I were talking about the physical vulnerability of examining a patient, and it's different based on various cultures that you're exposing yourself, and oftentimes as providers we end up taking that for granted because we do this all the time, every 10, 15 minutes. But some training, one of their providers that trained me was, we said in India, we start with the fingers and looking at the nails and then feeling the pulse and making our way in. But you in America go straight to the chest.
Yeah, and that's a startling thing, isn't it? You just go right for the chest. Yikes. Talking with some people who practice in Cambodia not long ago, and in at least some of the places over there, the karma teaching is such that if someone has high karma, like a medic, and there's someone with what they perceive to be low karma, which would be a patient because they're ill, someone with good karma never wants to touch someone with bad karma. So they literally do not teach physical exam. Isn't that interesting? So when the students come to learn, they have to be taught the very basics. But then also when the patients come, they're not expecting anybody to want to approach them. They have to be coached into here's how this goes. So that's a great point. Thank you. Good. Other thoughts? Yes, please.
Sometimes the mission field, depending, they may think they have to agree with your faith before they get care.
Ah.
I see now, do I need to seek Christ before I get care? Or that's always been implied. So, that's another one.
Yeah, really good. Yep, exactly. Implied. So, not something that they were told they had to do, but they assumed that that might be a part of the equation, right? Yeah, great. Oh, these are wonderful. Okay. Well, so one way of considering power is that it's the ability to do something that's denied to someone else. We're talking about knowledge. We're trained and we're licensed to do things that other people are not trained and are not licensed to do. If you think about it, we get to take knives and cut people and shock them. If someone on the street did that to someone else on the street, whole different outcome, right? But we're trained and licensed to do that for the benefit of the vulnerable. That is a power that is denied to other people. We can manage chemicals that are potentially toxic. Okay, same sort of thing. If that's done by someone who does it recreationally or for intention to cause harm, then that's a whole different item. And we are trusted so much with this power that we even get to charge for it. Right? Okay, so we have the ability to do some things that these things are denied to other people, and that is a power. And we were describing some other vulnerabilities, like entering someone's house or what we might find as we're asking questions. So reputation, that's a vulnerability. In the military, one time an executive officer came to my clinic with a sexually transmitted disease. Okay, if that information went to the wrong place, his career is very done and his marriage is very done. But of course, that is something that patients need to be able to make themselves vulnerable about in order to receive proper treatment, as you were describing. Modesty, we have said, is an important vulnerability. I mean, not to be crass or, too specific, but a pelvic exam is quite an event, really, if you think about it. How about financial vulnerability? Right. Okay, somebody comes in self-pay, and we order all sorts of stuff, right? Might that impoverish someone? One of my first misadventures on the mission field was inadvertently doing everything for someone who asked for everything, and they had to sell their farm in order to pay for the things that I had ordered. That was a vulnerability that I didn't understand at all, but grew to understand quickly. This is nothing new, these ideas. Hippocrates understood them very well. He said, okay, I'm not going to administer poison to anyone. I'm going to refrain from doing injury or wrong from falsehood or from acts of an amorous nature, taking advantage of those vulnerabilities. And whatever I may see or hear, I will keep it sacred and secret in my own heart. It is part of the Hippocratic Oath, right? Confidentiality, so that we don't abuse or misuse or have disdain for our patient's vulnerability. Why would patients put themselves in that kind of a vulnerable position?
Because they're patients.
Well, they're sick. So what do they want?
They need help.
Right. Okay. So that's the dynamic. They have to make themselves vulnerable in order for us to be able to use our power. You got to lie down on the table if the surgeon's going to do something, right? You have to do that. You have to be willing to have the IV put in your arm and that stuff going in there, whatever that is from their perspective. You have to be willing to do that in order to receive the power. What's your favorite definition of professionalism? Anybody have one they'd like to share? It's usually something real long, isn't it? You know? It's kind of nebulous, and we have trouble figuring that out. I wonder if this dynamic might not be a better way to understand professionalism, really. That we recognize that we have a lot of power, and our patients have great vulnerabilities, and we need to respect that and place barriers around ourselves in order not to, you know, abuse or not take into account the patient's vulnerability. I know that my power is very important, and so I'm going to study well and long in order to use my power very well for the benefit of my patients. I am not going to charge them more than is a reasonable amount. I'm not going to impoverish them. I'm not going to abuse their modesty or their reputation. I'm going to be careful that way. So just an understanding. So to summarize, I recognize my power, and I'm only going to use it for their benefit, and I'm going to see to it that my power is well exercised, well prepared, and is appropriate for use for them. Is this power vulnerability dynamic and the righteousness of it consistent with biblical teachings? Anybody have any ideas where you might find that? Well, we've been talking about person A and person B. Isn't there another person involved with this? Isn't there a third party to the power-vulnerability relationship? Isn't the Lord really concerned with how the powerful use their power, and that it would be for the benefit of the vulnerable? So this is Exodus, book 2, man. You know, the second one, you shall not wrong a stranger or oppress him. You shall not afflict any widow or orphan. Of course, talking to the powerful about the vulnerable. If you afflict him at all, and if he does cry out to me, I will surely hear his cry, and my anger will be kindled, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives shall become widows and your children fatherless. Wow! The Lord is concerned about power and its abuse of the vulnerable. If you don't take care of the vulnerable, you should be taking care of them. Further, I really love this example. John the Baptist, when he was approached by tax collectors and soldiers about what should we do, we assume that these are new people who he had baptized or who he's discipling in some way. The tax collectors came and said, "What should we do?" And John the Baptist said, "Don't collect any more than you're required to." Don't abuse your power, because they were given statutory ability to tax, right? The soldiers came and said, what should we do? He said, don't extort money. Don't accuse people falsely. Be content with your pay. Don't abuse your power. He did not tell them, don't be soldiers anymore, because soldiers are necessary to keep the peace, to defend the country. Peter, talking to the elders, is doing the same thing. I exhort the elders, says Peter, to shepherd the flock, not for sordid gain nor lording it over people. Don't abuse your power, but take care of those allotted to your charge. Prove to be examples to them. Okay? There are so many examples of this, of the Lord challenging kings because of their abuse, or the shepherds of Israel that they have not taken care of the flock or the widows or the orphans or things like that. And there are even some curses that followed with that from God to Israel because they have not been looking after the vulnerable. So power in that instance is a righteous thing. Okay? When it is used for the benefit of the vulnerable. But what about the biblical verse, since we're talking about biblical things, of power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely? What do you mean by that, sir? Is this a biblical verse?
No.
Okay, good. But what do you think about that? What do you think about, this? It seems like a truism, right? Power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. Anybody have any thoughts about this? Is it a real principle?
Power doesn't have to corrupt.
How do you mean? Okay. All right. So we have a choice to make if we have power. It doesn't necessarily have to corrupt. Are there plenty of examples of people who have power and who have become corrupted and use it for their own benefit? Happens a lot, doesn't it? Sadly, you know. And it does kind of seem like when people become especially powerful, it's kind of hard to keep from some sort of corruption. Is that not just a generally fair statement? But I agree, there is a choice involved, but Where did this come from, this phrase, you know? So it's usually quoted to, or it came from Lord Acton, who was a British politician and philosopher and writer. And in a letter to a friend, he wrote, power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Great men are almost always bad men. This was an opinion he was writing to a friend. It was not intended to be a public utterance or anything, but it was published later on, was grabbed onto, and so it describes a principle that a lot of people recognize. But it is not a biblical thing, and it is not like gravity. It's something that absolutely happens, although some people will quote it that way. Are there examples of absolute power not corrupting absolutely? Jesus. Thank you. Right. So, I love Philippians chapter 2, right? Did Jesus have absolute power? Sure he did. But he emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant, being made in the likeness of man. He humbled himself, becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Jesus had absolute power, and he was not corrupted absolutely. As a matter of fact, he used his absolute power for the benefit of all of us vulnerable. That's what he did with his power. So, when we're talking about is it appropriate to use power, and what about this corrupting power, it is important to compare the law of the jungle with the law of God. So the law of the jungle says, the powerful rule, right? A lion is not really concerned about the vulnerable, other than they're probably going to make a nice lunch for the lion, right? They use their power for their own benefit. Law of the jungle. Now, that's not necessarily evil, I don't think, but it certainly is one way the power is used. On the other hand, the law of the Lord is one that restrains power. When it would be used against the vulnerable. Do not kill. Do not commit adultery. Do not steal. You know, do not bear false witness, because everybody's vulnerable to that. Everybody's vulnerable to slander. So let us not do that. So we've been talking abstractly about power. What might abuse of medical power look like? What do you think? Go ahead. Okay, financial gain. Sure. So in what way? Have you seen that take a particular shape? Okay. All right. So cram as many patients in as you can, whether that's, you know, the individual seeing the patients or someone in a position of higher authority. Okay. Right. Make as much money as possible. Okay. Good. And that would be at the expense of taking better care of the patients. Got it. I agree. Yes, please. I'm sorry?
Larry Nassar.
Larry Nassar. Okay. What in particular? Right. So sexual abuse or taking advantage of that situation, it was terrible. Absolutely right. That is abuse of medical power. Good.
What about unnecessary procedures or kickbacks?
Unnecessary procedures or kickbacks. Sure. Well said. That definitely is. All right. Yes, please. Okay. All right. So, like withholding informed consent so that, you know, you're persuading them into doing something that might not be in their best interest, that kind of thing? Yeah. Good. All right. So, there are places around the world where if you want to be seen, you need to slip a little money in. Okay? Bribe your way through the system. Talking with, again, with our friends in Cambodia, that is simply the way it is done there. If you want to be seen, you bribe someone to get into the hospital. You bribe someone to not be at the very end of the line. You bribe someone to actually be into the room. You bribe the doctor to be seen. You bribe the pharmacist to actually give you a decent medication instead of something else. And it is a bribery all the way through. That is a power that people want to access, and it is abused for one's own personal benefit. And we talked about this very sad situation, another, you know, common thing around the world. If you want me to give your child a prescription, you'll show me a good time. So it's horrible, and it is sadly common, an abuse of power. Right. So perhaps to summarize, power is righteously used for the benefit of the vulnerable. Right. I think we can land pretty hard on that. And in medicine, the power dynamic may be more clearly understood from the perspective of the vulnerability of the patient. So with soldiers, with public officials, they impose their power on someone else, not so much us. In general, it is the patients seeking our power rather than us imposing our power on someone else. And power can corrupt, but that corruption is hardly inevitable. People who are righteous and virtuous and are serving, and remember that we actually have a third party involved in this, tend to perhaps be a little more rigorous about maintaining the correct righteous dynamic. So now we've been talking about medicine in general, and let's consider, might there be something different in the context of missions? One time at our hospital in Chagoria, we were in Chagoria, Kenya, just on the eastern slopes of Mount Kenya, roughly in the middle of the country. And one day a motorcycle drove up and dropped off a lady that looked a lot like this. That's not her, but she was a Samburu lady, like this lady. Came from about three hours by motorcycle north of us. And she was quite ill, needed to go into the hospital. And she did not speak the language of the folks where we were, and we did not speak her language. What other vulnerabilities might exist with this lady? Yes, please. Okay. Can't even give consent if you don't understand what's happening. Good. Okay. We can't treat her if we don't know what's wrong with her. It's a whole different matter, isn't it? So, you know, Yeah, when patients can't communicate. Yes, please. Okay, so she may have completely different beliefs about what sort, what should be done for her. We think in the terms of Western biomedicine, well said, and she might not have that worldview at all and not understand anything that we're trying to do with her, right? Maybe she's never seen an IV needle, for Pete's sake. You know. But, yes, please, Nicole.
Maybe separated from her primary decision makers. And we had patients in Zambia who came from far away, and they told us, you know, when you tell us to come back in a couple of months or a year, we're separated from, like, it's a long way back home. And so we're just living on the streets until you tell us to come back, or our families are living on the streets all the way here.
Great. Yeah, great example. So, yeah, separated from the family, not having resources, who knows how long they have to stay until the family comes back. That's very good for that context. Anything else? All right. She may have no ability to pay. Right? And this lady didn't. She showed up with nothing. Except the beads. You know, she had a lot of those. Just interesting setup there. You're talking about the expectation earlier that one would adopt this spirituality in order to be seen. You think she might be thinking that? Okay. We've had that happen with, you know, Muslim patients who come with great hostility because they expect that they're going to be, you know, streeted unless we compel them to be Christians or something like that. Big education differential. And of course, that the language barriers there. So, the power differential is especially significant for someone like this, right? If you're a patient and you're making yourself vulnerable to power, that's one thing. She has no idea what's going on. Yeah, completely foreign situation, very vulnerable. So, what do you think about the role of a mission hospital and of our hope to share Jesus with people in the setting of such profound vulnerability? Is it right to do that? Or is this actually the better tack to take? So this is from the American Medical Association Journal of Ethics, Illuminating the Art of Medicine, a viewpoint that physicians and patient spirituality, why a patient's religion is not their doctor's business. By Dr. Sloan, PhD. So his contention was, okay, people may feel compelled to adopt someone's spirituality. One is as good as another. Why should your ideology be imposed upon a patient who is vulnerable? By the way, doctors don't know any more about spiritual things than any other layman, so, you know, why are they compelling people? So those are among the ideas that's in this article. What do you think about that? Yes, please.
I think it's interesting that he's a PhD and not an MD, a DO. Just the more I can know about what my patient's thinking, and that's going to affect so many parts of the system that I want to involve.
Yeah. Yep, well said. Okay. So yeah, what the patients are needing is really going to affect how I'm going to approach that. Yes, please. I think that's a wonderful answer. Their spirituality may be the foremost of what they're seeking, and so approaching that is really important. So I love it. Yeah, go ahead.
A patient's religious beliefs or culture might prevent them from receiving specific treatment, like, for example, the homeless witness expanding blood treatment.
Sure. Yeah, their beliefs may prevent certain sorts of treatment, like a Jehovah's Witness and blood transfusions. Yes, please.
There's a difference between understanding the patient's religion versus
Okay. Difference between understanding their religion and imposing ours on them, if that's the way it feels, please.
Only someone's religion might give you an indication of their support system.
Okay. Yeah, so it may have implications for their support system. All right. So these are really good. And I want to share something that happened to me early on during our time in Chagoria. So this is one of our chaplains, Eliphaz Mutegi. He's a trained nurse who gave up nursing in order to be a hospital chaplain. A very good friend, fine man of God, and we would round together at times. And early on, I knew of the power distance sort of thing. Okay, I'm a Western guy with gray hair. You know, that automatically puts me in a power position. I'm the doctor there, the patient, that sort of thing. And so I was trying to be all very sensitive about this. And so I asked Eliphaz, you know, I'd like to have opportunity to pray with some patients. How can I invite them to pray without abusing this power dynamic? And Eliphaz looked at me and he said, "You Americans are so afraid." He said, "We Africans know that there is a spiritual component to illness. We know about spirits and curses and how bitterness can lead to illness, that sort of thing. We know that. It's you people who seem to have forgotten that. We want you to engage the spiritual side. And if you, as the Christian in the mission hospital, don't address that, when they leave the hospital, they will go to the witch doctor, to Mganga, to have that dealt with." He said, "Don't fail to pray with your patients. And don't ask me questions like that again." A very unusual Kenyan. Kenyans are normally, you know, not very confrontational. Eliphaz is a whole different setting. Dear brother, love him. But that was it. You know, we were talking about this before. That may be what they're primarily there for. Again, talking with our friends in Cambodia, the spirits there are oppressing them, and they know their illness is often due to that, and they come to the Christian hospital to see if there's any power. Does the Christian God have any power? And from my friends in their discussion, they say, "And boy, does the Lord show up." That medical miracles are simply commonplace. They can't predict them, they can't promise them, but they happen so routinely that it doesn't surprise anybody anymore. Okay, so this may be the primary reason that people are coming. And so avoiding approaching that may be really problematic. So, on the other hand, what might abuse of power in a mission hospital look like? Abuse of our power with vulnerable patients in the spiritual setting of a mission hospital. Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah. That's way too common, isn't it? You know, we think it's better because it's Western, but you know, they're thinking that it's spiritual.
Well, kind of like what you said about not praying with your patients. Like, if that's what they're coming there for, mm-hmm. and that's our God-given job to do, mm-hmm. and then you don't do it, you just kind of say, "Well, you don't need that. You're good. Go okay. Carry on. Get on the other way. We've got numbers to see. Let's go."
You bet.
Yeah. So.
Okay. Yeah. If that's what they came for, just dismissing that as superstition or whatever, and pressing on. You know, not good. Great. Okay. Yes, please.
Neglecting physical treatment and focusing only on spiritual matters.
Okay. Neglecting the physical and only acting on the spiritual may also be kind of an abuse of power, assuming that we know better. So we already touched on this idea of there are some expectations and even some places who might say, if you don't accept Christianity, we will not treat you. All right? Or if you accept Christianity, we will give you this medicine, that sort of a thing. So that, in my opinion, is a spiritual abuse of that setting. Is that what tends to happen in mission hospitals?
No.
I've never seen it, actually, in practice. Actually, very much the opposite. We will take care of you. I remember one time when we had a Muslim man who came to our place with his mother-in-law, and he shoved his way to the front of the line expecting to encounter great hostility. He said, "This woman is sick," he said, "and we will be seen." And it just turned out that I was working in the ER in casualty, and a bed had just opened up. I thought, well, let's see what this does. And so I just ushered him right in there and took care of his mother-in-law. And he was dumbfounded. that we would take care of him even ahead of some other people. We didn't have anybody who was terribly sick who'd been waiting in line. Towards the end of it, I invited him to pray. I said, would you like to pray in Isa's name? Isa being the Muslim name for Jesus, right? And he was again just stunned. He said, I would love to pray for my mother-in-law. And so we prayed in Isa's name. And I had a new best friend. He was all around the hospital. When are you going to come visit with us some more? I said, I work in the casualty. He said, no, you have to come to us. So yeah, accepting people, it is the opposite. Accepting people who don't believe what we're doing is actually what is commonplace in mission hospitals. Very much different from abuse. So I do agree with Dr. Sloan that we do have an obligation to deliver medical care to all those who seek it, not just those who share their religious convictions. That's a quote from his paper. What does the word abdication mean? Yes, please. Oh, yeah, go ahead. Okay. 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 So you have a withholding, a rightful position, and a rightful authority, giving that up for some reason, avoiding that. Okay, right. An act of abandoning or discarding a right, responsibility, or authority. Anybody know who this guy is, by the way? It's King Edward VIII, who abdicated, and his brother took over the crown of England, that sort of thing. So he avoided that kind of authority. So I think you made a point up here just a few minutes ago that when we have a responsibility to exercise a power and we don't do that, that is an abdication of responsibility, an abdication of power. Soldiers should use their power for the benefit of, you know, the unarmed populace. Police officers should use their power. If you've ever been in a court case where the judge should have acted and chose not to, why didn't you act? You could have really done something good, but you didn't do it. So public officials should do that. It's actually a part of healing for us to use our power for that. So power is bestowed for a reason, with a responsibility to use it. Nehemiah used his power, right? Joseph used his power. We are so glad that he did that. Hippocrates used his power. All of this is very good. So we need to not be afraid to use our power for the benefit of the vulnerable. This is a situation where it may actually be more abusive of our power if we don't use it, if you will. We're going to contrast that with Isaiah 32, verses 1 through 5. In our devotions this morning, we came across this, and I thought, this is just too good. So this is Isaiah 32. Behold, a king will reign righteously, and princes will rule justly. Each will be like a refuge from the wind and a shelter from the storm, like streams of water in a dry country, like the shade of a huge rock in a parched land. Then the eyes of those who see will not be blinded, and the ears of those who hear will listen. The mind of the hasty will discern the truth, and the tongue of the stammerers will hasten to speak clearly. No longer will the fool be called noble, or the rogue be spoken of as generous. So the king and the prince are to rule righteously. It sets the kingdom up for success. When we practice medicine, and including spiritual healing, then that is a wonderful use of our power. So again, going back to Sloan's idea, which is shared by many people, if Christianity really is merely one among many valid beliefs, no more valid than anything else, if medicine is purely physical and it has no spiritual meaning, then perhaps they're right. And we shouldn't involve spiritual things in the care of our patients, even in mission hospitals. But if patients are spiritually seeking, and they're asking spiritual questions like, why do you think this is happening? Why has God allowed this? Which is not a mechanical question. It's one of meaning, that in which their illness has meaning that we're supposed to help them figure out. If they are fearful about death, because those of us who believe should have no fear of death, and we can help them with that. If Christianity is not just one among many valid beliefs, if it actually is the way, the truth, and the life, if healing is a work of body and soul in the entire life, healing is a good thing. If our souls are eternal, and what happens as a result of that encounter really matters, then I would submit that the only proper thing is for us to engage them spiritually with knowledge, powerful knowledge that they have that they might not ever encounter otherwise. To do otherwise is an abdication of power, an abdication of our responsibility. So, if we think about, are we abusing power to spiritually engage our patients? Another way of considering it is, do you think we really have the power to require our patients to convert? You know, they may say something, but there's no way that we really have that kind of a power. Many of our patients come seeking healing. Maybe medicine, maybe not. Maybe that's a part of things, but they come seeking healing. That's more of a holistic thing, something that does involve the spiritual person. And it is appropriate for us to engage that. Again, as Eliphaz said, their spiritual needs may be foremost among the reasons that they came to the hospital. And we may have life-changing or eternal life-giving news for those people. So, what do you think? Remember back at the beginning where we were saying, do you seek power? Anybody feel a little uncomfortable about this? No, I don't seek power. I think we should seek power. We should learn how to be powerful in our fields, in our practice, in our profession. We should learn those new things to do, the ways to benefit people, to seek to have authority to make things right, to move into leadership when that time is appropriate in order to make things right, to structure it so that it is for the benefit of the vulnerable. Like the verse said, the king who rules righteously, if we can get into a position of seeing to it that things are done righteously, that's beautiful. And it is the kind of power that is for the benefit of the vulnerable. And in the mission setting, when people are expecting abuse or hostility or to be shunned, and they encounter something different, oh my, is that powerful. Like I was telling you about the Muslim man who became my new best friend. It really, really speaks to them. And the Bible talks about eagerly seeking greater spiritual gifts so that we will be able to provide those for the benefit of the vulnerable. And so when you look at these, so many of these do have someone who's vulnerable or a receiver on the other end of this gift. Right? A teacher teaches someone who needs to receive that. Helps someone who needs help. A prophet to put out the truth, that sort of a thing. And what's the greater gift that's missing from this list that is scriptural? Well, no, that's exactly right. It's a greater spiritual gift. Shouldn't we engage in that? Because when you think about it, when a man brings you his desperately ill only child in the setting where we practice overseas, and he has no idea what to do about this. He doesn't know what's wrong with this child. He just knows something is terribly, terribly wrong. And he has no power, no knowledge, no skills to do anything about it. And he brings them to you, and he has nothing to offer you. He can't pay for what you're doing, and he knows it, and you know it. All he can do is trust in your power and your goodness. And you use that power for the benefit of these desperately vulnerable people. Is there any more Christ-like act in this world than something like that? It is beautiful. It's a wonderful thing. It speaks volumes spiritually to people. And you see gratitude that just can't come in any other way. And when we show them the reason for that, they ask, why are you here doing this for us? You say, because he did it for all of us. And we can share the power that he had and the way that he used that for the benefit of all of us vulnerable people. Oh my goodness. again, that's the gospel. It's a beautiful thing. So please, seek power, use it for those people. Help them understand it, share it with them, and give praise to the one who shared some power with us in the first place. Can I pray for us? Lord, please help us to remember that You are the powerful one, and we are Your children, and we are grateful that You delegate some power to us to use for the sake of each other. Please help us to keep that in mind and to remember that power is not to be shunned and it is not to be abused. Please help us to point people back to You as we use it. May we delight in that and have joy in it. And it's in the most powerful name in the universe, that of Jesus Christ the righteous, that we pray. Amen.